Thank you for listening to We Have Ways of Making You Talk. Sign up to our Patreon to receive bonus content, live streams, and our weekly newsletter with money off books and museum visits as well, plus early access to all live show tickets. That's patreon.com/wehaveways.
I'm Anthony Scaramucci, former White House Director of Communications and Wall Street financier.
And I'm Katty Kay, U.S. Special Correspondent for BBC Studios. I've been covering American politics for almost 3 decades.
Welcome to The Rest is Politics U.S., brought to you by Goalhanger.
In this pivotal year for the United States, democracy, and world affairs, Britain's biggest podcast, The Rest is Politics, is launching stateside.
Uncovering secrets from inside the Biden and Trump inner circles and how they shape the world's most important economy, but also the global economy too.
New episodes are released every Friday morning.
Just search The Rest is Politics US wherever you get your podcasts.
Achtung, Achtung. Welcome to We Have Ways of Making You Talk with me, Al Murray, and James Holland, of course, in this bumper stuffed Subway sandwich of lockdown extra goodies. We've got all the toppings. James, who are we joined by today? And I'm very excited about this.
Yeah, this feels like this is the daddy, doesn't it? Because we've got Professor John Buckley, of whom you and I are obvious acolytes. And John is a professor of military history at Wolverhampton University. The first such undergraduate course in the country, I think I'm right in saying. And he is someone who has had an enormous impact and influence on my writing and my understanding of the Second World War, and indeed yours I think.
And a university that had the good sense to give me an honorary doctorate as well. So
scoring it all. You jammy sod.
So today we're saying hello to John Buckley. Well, welcome, John.
Hi, thanks for joining us. Glad to be here.
James, you go first because you're absolutely bursting with questions. Go.
Well, I have, and you know, John and I have sort of, you know, irregular conversations, don't we, John? Where we sort of chew the cud, and it's always incredibly useful. So my issue at the moment that I'm my little conundrum, not conundrum, but my little sort of thing I'm trying to untangle, is that it's very clear to me in the early stages of the Normandy campaign, I'm particularly looking at the Sherwood Rangers at the moment, who are obviously part of 8th Armoured Brigade, and in their first engagements, they're first setting off from the D-Day beaches, they're going inland as 8th Armoured Brigade. They're not operating with infantry to start off with, the 50th Division. They've left them behind, and they're doing a holding operation on a bit of high ground called Point 103, which is between the village of Audroy and Tilly-sur-Soule. And they end up getting bogged down there for quite a long time, not least because the Panzer Lehr turn up at exactly the opposite side of the Soule River. And they have a massive ding-dong, which doesn't really kind of sort itself out till the very end of June 1944. But in that middle section of June, so around the sort of 17th, 16th, 17th, 18th, 19th, the armour of 8th Armour Brigade, of which Sherwood Rangers obviously is a part, is operating with, I think it's the 49th Division. And it is clear that armour infantry cooperation is absolutely, well, it's not appalling, but it's not good. It's not good at all. And you can see from the commander, the tank commander's comments in war diaries, in accounts of O groups and meetings at 8th Armour Brigade and all the rest of it, that that they're all getting very, very frustrated that the infantry don't seem to be kind of sticking with them, and that the moment the enemy open up, they hit the deck and the guys in the tanks are left abandoned and then can no longer communicate with them. Now, if everyone's been kind of, you know, training in England for, or either they've got lots of experience from North Africa or they've been training in England, certainly for 6 months, but in many cases for kind of 2 years, why on earth haven't they done more training beforehand with armour?
Well, the principal reason is that the whole idea of how the British Army approaches doctrine and training, which is something dates back to the 19th century, but carries on through the First World War, but also into the Second World War, which is basically you make it up as you go along. And the idea of doctrine, a written formal doctrine, how you do this, how you have ideas on mixing infantry and armour together in battle. It's left to middle-ranking commanders to interpret. So it's not fixed, it's not set, it's open to the commanders to decide on how they approach things. As long as they don't break the doctrine, it's up to them how they then put it into action. Which is good in many circumstances. If you've got an army which is operating across the globe in various imperial ventures and so on in the 19th century, early 20th century, you need flexibility. The commander's got to be able to interpret doctrine and ideas, how you do things as you see fit on the ground. So it's understandable why they approach it in the way they do. And that latitude is good in lots of circumstances. But when it comes to fixing a mass army to take on the Germans in the Second World War, it isn't really the most appropriate way to do things. And so what you get by the time of Normandy is commanders interpreting experience, who they've last spoken to, official doctrine, and they put their own ideas together. So different formations start the Normandy campaign with, as you say, some of them are experienced from North Africa, which isn't always a good thing because it teaches them bad habits and the wrong approach. It doesn't really work very well in Northwest Europe. You've got some units in the UK that have been training in Britain, but with limited scope to train, really. There's not that much space. Farmers don't like it if you yomp across their fields and destroy their crops in 1943. So you have limited scope to carry out these kind of manoeuvres and this kind of training. And so they interpret doctrine in a different way. If they've had conferences and they've spoken to different commanders and different people in the field, they come at it with different ideas. So what you get in the first weeks of Normandy is an army which has got uneven doctrine and uneven ways of approaching things. And that particularly plays out in this problem that you're referring to, infantry armour cooperation, because that is the biggest difficulty that armies have to deal with during the Second World War. Which they still haven't really resolved until, well, much later in the Normandy campaign, maybe even into the autumn of 1944. And that is how you get infantry and armour to cooperate and work closely together. They don't have a set method of doing things, nor, in fact, does anybody by this stage. You know, we always hear about how the Germans are fantastic at mixing infantry and armour together and their blitzkrieg, panzergrenadier kind of stuff.
The Kampfgruppen and all the rest
Absolutely,
of it.
Absolutely, yeah, yeah. And it doesn't work in 1944 because the Allies have got such massive artillery. If you start trying to manoeuvre around infantry in half-track vehicles and things and keep them moving forward in an offensive, they'll get plastered, which is exactly what happened all the time.
Especially if you're not in control of the air, which is so. The moment you can't fight in 3D, that gets much more difficult. I mean, it is interesting, isn't it? Because you touched on it there. The idea that the Germans are brilliant at all this, but the Germans are more doctrinally unified, aren't they? Because basically, they either go east or they go west. The German army, they've got two directions to travel. Yeah. Sometimes south, but either east or west, and that's basically it. Whereas, as you say, if you're an infantry battalion, I mean, it's posted to Malta in 1938. Mm. Your experience is of sort of a bit of policing and drinking gin and tonics, isn't it? Playing cricket, and after all, you've also got that interwar culture of some people. Obviously, they don't think they're ever going to have to fight another war like this ever again. Some people don't want to ever have to fight a war or think about a war like this ever again. And then obviously the bods and the boffins and the brains going away trying to work it out. But that's all being done in a vacuum as well, where you can't, like you say, you can't practice. There's no money to do it. And also no political intention of, you know, the 10-year rule.
I mean, it's really interesting because among the Sherwood Rangers accounts, a lot of them are saying, we realised very, very quickly that Normandy is not like North Africa. It's not even like Northern Tunisia. Mm. That this is very close combat. This is going to require a completely different way of thinking and operating. And so instead of operating as a regiment, which is basically what they were doing in North Africa, they're now operating as squadrons, where quite often they're completely detached from regimental headquarters, apart from kind of, you know, occasionally the CO turns up. Mm-hmm. or occasional kind of sort of radio contact and rest of it, but they can be operating completely different parts of the battlefield from one another. And someone who's got a friend in A squadron who's in C squadron might not see him for weeks or certainly long days. So they are kind of, you know, already that's very different. I suppose my big point is, you know, whenever I've interviewed people, I've said, did you do any all-arms training? And they all say, no.
No.
except that, you know, when you read Stanley Christopherson's diaries, who becomes the commanding officer of the Sherwood Rangers, when he's in Tunisia at the beginning of January 1943, he said, we recognise the importance of doing more all-arms training. So we got together with some of the infantry of the division we're working with, and with our artillery, and we started doing some really hardcore training because we've all realised that we need to kind of up our game and kind of improve. Mm-hmm. And so that's a kind of a comparatively rare instance of it. But certainly for those in England, in the build-up to... I don't think I've ever come across anyone who I've interviewed who's said that they did any all-arms training. And you do wonder why. You know, even if they're being left to kind of work it out for themselves once they get out there... The very concept of it is something that you need to think about. Why is that? Because it's so obvious. You know, you can't tell me that kind of Alexander and Montgomery and Ronald Adam and Brooke and all these people don't understand the concept of all-arms training.
No. I mean, Monty's very keen on the idea. he comes back, but in typical Monty fashion, he comes back from North Africa at the beginning of 1944 and starts trying to throw his weight around about how to do everything. And he tries to impose... kind of the Eighth Army method of infantry armour cooperation. There are all sorts of different techniques, and if you really want to go into the doctrine of how it's all supposed to be done, there's kind of like something called the sandwich method, where you led with some tanks, the infantry follow on immediately behind, and there are more tanks behind to provide support, and mixing all of that together is a real issue. But Monty's approach was that you do what we've done in the desert. And his experience and his learning and the kind of doctrine he wants to bring back with him is that which worked mainly in the deserts of Libya and Egypt, which isn't entirely applicable. The problem those in England have when he comes back and starts saying, this is how you do this and this is the doctrine I want to use, is that it's very difficult, one, to say no to Monty, because he's Monty, and two, it's difficult to say no to the only serious winning army that the British have managed to build during the Second World War by that time. So the resistance breaks down. So there is an impasse between Monty's approach, which is to do things where you often fight to a degree with separate infantry and armour formations. What you don't want, which will happen in the desert, is the slower moving infantry having to be supported by your faster moving army. You want to give the armour the freedom to manoeuvre over wide open terrain and so on. And that works.
But isn't that the principle of the armoured division as opposed to the independent armoured brigade? Because you have the independent armoured brigade, you know, in theory, kind of operating hand in glove with an infantry division. So an armoured brigade, you've got your three armoured regiments, one for each of the infantry battalions to support one of each infantry battalions. But when you've got an armoured division, the armoured division is there to exploit and kind of, you know, go off and swan off on
But in both cases, they haven't really worked through how that's going to be done. Within the armoured division, you're right, it's kind of a separate role, but the infantry and the armoury is intended to fight separately. But they quickly work out that doesn't work. Even an experienced commander, so Pip Roberts, 11th Armoured Division, comes back and he's a wealth of experience in North Africa. And it takes him a while to get his formation, his new charges, who are mostly inexperienced, to do what he wants them to do with his much more integrated approach, which comes later in the campaign. But there's another level of difficulty in that the official doctrine of how you do this is just starting to catch up based on the experience of the Mediterranean, the problems of infantry armour cooperation. Right. But the final doctrine is only issued in about April, May of 1944. So it's a bit late in the day to suddenly change everything. And one of the difficulties they have is that the independent brigades were originally supposed to be all equipped with Churchill tanks for close infantry support. And so they had an idea of how that would work. The armour being more, the tank being more thickly protected, thicker armour, would be able to go in close with the infantry in attacks. But it became apparent by late 1943 that was never going to happen. They simply couldn't produce enough Churchills. And so they started having to use Shermans for these independent brigades, such as the 8th. And Monty was all in favour of that. He wanted a single tank. He didn't like the Churchill at all. It kept breaking down. British tanks are rubbish. We want American tanks. The Sherman works. We want that.
Well, and it had done well from Alamein again. Yeah. So it's this thing of he's looking at his winning streak, isn't he? And why wouldn't you?
Absolutely. You know? I mean, you look at the experience of the British Army up until 1942, and all the British tanks are rubbish. They don't do what they're supposed to do. They break down, even when they're technically good in some respects, like the Matilda. They break down all the time. So there are the real difficulties. So the first tank the British Army gets, which really seems to work, is the Sherman. So they want that, and they only want that. And in some ways, it makes things nice and simple. The problem is, in an infantry support role, the Sherman's not very good. It's got nice firepower, but it's very lightly armoured. And so what you get is the different formations prior to Normandy and in the early weeks of Normandy working out the right kind of tactics. There were some ideas that you could use an infantry support role. You'd have to use the Sherman as a standoff weapon. So rather than going in with the infantry onto a target, you'd have to stand off and fire the infantry, which doesn't work very well, because as soon as you get to contact, the infantry reach their target, the Shermans are behind firing in support of them. But you get smoke and dust and all kind of nonsense. They can't see anything anymore. So suddenly, just at the moment when the infantry need it, the armour is a few hundred yards behind, unable to support effectively. But if they're going too close to the infantry, they get shot to pieces by lighter German anti-tank guns. So the Churchill could do that more effectively. But you've got different kind of doctrine ideas, but then you've got different types of equipment and different information about how you use this kind of stuff. And Monty at the top saying, no, one doctrine, one method. And the Royal Armoured Corps saying, that's not going to work. We need different doctrines. So there's a real level of confusion at the start of the campaign, with some units adopting some approaches relevant to the kind of kit they've been supplied with, and other formations doing different things. The armoured divisions have this kind of idea of fighting separately with infantry and armour. But when, as James says, once you get into the campaign, that's not going to work. Then you get the independent brigades who are trying to work out this flexible role. They're mixing between different infantry formations all the time. And because the British Army tends to work on word of mouth rather than doing it by a written doctrine, it works best if the infantry and the armoured formations have a bit of workup time. James is saying, if they discuss things,
yeah,
talk
and
things
that
through.
Is a problem. Yeah. And what's absolutely clear with the arrival of the 49th Division is, I think they, you know, some of the units have been involved in Dunkirk, but they haven't really basically been in action. The 6th and the 7th Duke of Wellington's haven't been in action. They've been in Iceland. I think the 6th Duke of Wellington's been on Iceland. Mm. But they haven't really been in action since 1940. So this is, you know, so pretty much all their personnel are brand new to combat. And there's been no work-up time whatsoever. And they go into battle and they're doing their one thing. And the tanks are trying to do what they're supposed to do to support them. And then suddenly they're finding that the infantry are kind of sort of deserting them and leaving them. And they don't know what's going on. And as you say, the smoke and fog of war suddenly hits them and they're exposed.
Yes, absolutely.
But what they do, you know, but they start, you can see them all kind of, all the tank guys all kind of sort of trying to work out how to kind of improve things. And one of them is that, you know, the allotted fireflies, for example, have been with the squadron headquarters. It's like a squadron headquarters of three or four tanks, and I think it's four tanks, and they're all fireflies. So instead of having three tank troops, they then make four-man troops and add one of the fireflies to it. And they're just, and I know other armoured units are coming to that same conclusion, but that is arrived at quite independently by the Sherwood Rangers at this point. Before
but they
the
only got the fire, they only got firefly at the last minute as well. So you've
there's
got
342 that's on D-Day.
Yeah, and they're delivered in May or something, aren't they? So what you've got is a sort of you know, the aspirations of doctrine versus the reality of the battlefield. Sure. You've then got the interpretations of doctrine by individual commanders. From top to bottom. So you've got Monty attempting to set the agenda. Then various divisional commanders going, well, he's wrong about that. Lieutenant brigadiers, then lieutenant colonels, they run their battalion their way, thank you very much. Then the armoured squadrons, they do things. I mean, you can see why this might happen. I mean, I, rather than, because after all, all of this is the difference between, you know, in the clinch of battle, everything, obviously everything's completely different to anything anyone would expect. And you can have the cleverest people on this and the most experienced, but Normandy presents obviously different challenges to Sicily, to Italy, to the desert, to anywhere else. And but is there not someone saying, you do know Normandy's going to be completely different to everywhere else? Or are they all like, beetling on? Yeah.
There's a guy called Tick Bonesteel, who is an American planner, General Bonesteel. He becomes General Bonesteel, but this time he is very involved with the planning for Sicily. Then he gets brought over, and he's very involved with the planning for 21st Army Group. And then he goes over to Bradley's staff, and he is writing all sorts of reports about the Bocage. And saying everyone's focusing on the D-Day, but actually what you really need to think about is what it's going to be like inland. Bocage. You know, what you really need is some Pershings and all the rest of it. And there's very good reasons for not having Pershings. But he's one of the proponents of bringing in a heavy tank. But his reasons for doing it are his arguments about the Pershing are questionable. But his warnings about the nature of the geography in Normandy and what is going to face them when they get over there is absolutely spot on. Mm. And my own take on this is, and John, you'll know better than me, is that it's not that they don't know this, that, you know, the guys at the top, the Montes and Bradleys and all the rest of it and Dempseys, it's that I can't really do anything about it. I mean, you know, from what you're saying, it's all very well saying, you know, me saying, well, why on earth don't they train? Well, they can't train because there isn't the space in Britain. There isn't the capacity. They don't have enough heavily armoured tanks of Churchill's. You know, there's a whole host of other factors, industrial, economic, situation of the war, all the rest of it, which is mitigating against all arms training and the kind of working up with infantry. I mean, the bottom line is these independent armoured brigades have to operate with, they have to be flexible and operate with numbers of different infantry units, because infantry units simply, it's unsustainable keeping them in the front line for more than about 6 days at a go. You know, 10 days absolutely tops. Because after that, their casualties are so great that they can no longer properly function. And one of the great virtues of the British system, and indeed the American system, is that there is this ability, there is enough to be able to kind of rotate people in and out and you know, put in new replacements and all the rest of it. But the consequence of that is that British armour, particularly the independent armour brigades, are having to suddenly find themselves in a situation in the middle of a tough fight where they're suddenly operating alongside the 49th Division, for example, who are brand new to combat, with no workup time whatsoever. And that's not really the fault of anybody. That's just the circumstances and the situation of the war and all the rest of it. Would you agree with that, or is that some way?
Yeah, no, I think that's entirely true. And there's a further point that you're right that they haven't got the time or the space and so on to train in the particular kind of ways they expect to fight in Normandy. But we've also got to bear in mind as well that the plan was not to fight in Normandy very long. They don't expect to be fighting in that awful terrain. So if you've got a fixed amount of time to train and prepare, you train and prepare for the campaign you think you're going to fight. And Allied planning is very much that they don't think the Germans will be dumb enough to fight close to the beach, where the Allies will have overwhelming naval gunfire, it'll be closer to the UK, for air support, and to fight a fairly static campaign, because in a way that kind of played into Allied hands, so the Allies believed, about what the German intentions would be. I mean, there's the counter-argument that once you allow the Allies to swarm out all over France, you create all sorts of difficulties yourself. So you can kind of see there is some rational thinking behind the German strategy, but overall it doesn't make that much sense. So they think the Germans will play a fighting retreat game. So as soon as the Allies land, get established, no point fighting here anymore, we'll back off into terrain where we can use our clever manoeuvre tactics and try and catch the Allies out a little bit because we're better at it than they are, so they believed. But of course, the Germans don't do that. They dig in and fight like hell in Normandy and reduce everything to an attritional, fairly static campaign for a few weeks. Now, that creates all sorts of difficulties for the for the Allies and those units which are expecting to fight a more fluid kind of campaign. And as we know, it turns it into much more of an infantry intensive campaign. But it also creates enormous difficulty for the Germans as well, because basically their resources get chewed up by the Allied mincing machine of the artillery and firepower and naval gunfire and so on, to such a point that eventually the Germans break. And then you get the fluid campaign. But the tactics that you would adopt, or the doctrine, the training that you're supposedly adopting, even though we can see it's rather uneven, would be based upon where you think you're going to fight most of the campaign. And that would be in more open terrain, further out into France and away from Normandy. So there's kind of a reasoning behind why they end up training and planning to do what they do. But they get caught out a little bit. But equally, the Germans shoot themselves in the foot by carrying out that kind of strategy.
Which leads to the question, why do the Germans make this mistake?
Well, it's a combination. As I mentioned, the commanders on the spot want to fight further away from the coast. Their idea is to play a fighting retreat. But there are some who are arguing, well, look what happens if you try and fight out in the open and manoeuvre around a lot during this period. Because the Allies got such overwhelming air support. If you try and do that, you'll get hit really hard. And you get a conflict between those commanders who've seen more action on the Eastern Front and those who've seen more action in the Mediterranean. The Eastern Front commanders don't really appreciate what Allied air power appears to be able to do. And so they're more willing to fight a more fluid battle. The Western Front commanders tend to say, well, hang on, if you manoeuvre around too much out in the open, particularly during daylight, we'll get badly hit by the Allied air forces. Look what's been happening in North Africa and in Italy and so on. And in Northwest Europe, it's going to be much, much worse. So there is a battle going on within German high command about how you best fight the Allies. The balance is more in favour of manoeuvring and getting away from naval guns and so on, and what you're going to get hit with in Normandy. But nonetheless, there is still an ongoing battle. But then you also have the bigger strategic level of Hitler and Berlin saying, don't worry, there's loads of stuff that's going to arrive, dig in and hold the position as long as possible. And if we can stalemate it till the autumn, we're in with a chance of holding this, holding the invasion in place. And this is why the Allies had delayed from 1943 to 44. What they didn't want was to land and then get stuck and then have a big, long winter of attrition, not really going anywhere. So, again, you can see why German thinking is pinned on that. It's just unrealistic. And it's not matching the available resources to the strategic situation they've got themselves into, which is ongoing. I've heard you guys talk about this before. About there's just a complete mismatch between capability and resources.
We're going to take a short break now. James and I are talking to John Buckley. Welcome back to We Have Ways of Making You Talk with me, Al Murray, and James Holland. We're talking to John Buckley.
But it really is Hitler who's driving this kind of fight for every yard, don't give up, and all the rest of it. Because I mean, there's the infamous meeting between Rommel and him at Margeville, and when Rommel sort of goes, "It is insane not to let me withdraw my troops from the Copenhagen Peninsula. We cannot win this." So the net result of that is they're going to get trapped, and you are going to lose all those forces. Whereas if you allow me to withdraw them from the Copenhagen Peninsula, then they can at least be used at a later stage as well, in the battle. And Hitler goes, absolutely not. You know, you must, Cherbourg is a festung, it must be required. You know, can't let the Allies get their hands on that port. Little, and again, kind of totally failing to appreciate that the port of Cherbourg is frankly inconsequential to the outcome of the Normandy campaign. You know, they're landing all their stuff on the beaches and through the mulberries and all the rest of it. They don't need that port particularly. I mean, useful, but it's not essential by any stretch of the imagination. And it's just that, you know, it's Hitler completely misreading it. And, you know, you do get this sort of tantalising glimpse, don't you, of Rommel in the middle of July, just before he's wounded on the 17th of July, where he's starting to talk with and get the coercion of the senior Waffen-SS generals as well, saying, this is insane. You know, we should fall back or call a peace with the Allies or, you know, do something because this isn't working.
Mm. Absolutely. And what you see is a kind of, as more commanders arrive from the Eastern Front or those who've had limited experience fighting in the West, arrive in Normandy full of bravado about how it's going to be done and how they're going to do this, that and the other. Then they arrive within a few days saying, it doesn't really work, does it? We've got a real problem here and we've got to back off. And that's a repeated message coming through. But of course, the timing of it's important. Firstly, Rommel gets wounded and comes out of the battle. But of course, on the 20th, you have the bomb plot. So nobody's going to tell Hitler from 20 July onwards, actually, you're wrong on this and we need to withdraw. Rundstedt's about the only person who could, and he's gone, or they get rid of him. And he keeps telling Hitler, you're wrong, and that's why he keeps getting sacked. But no one's listening in Berlin. And whilst there is a scintilla of understandable logic in why you don't want to withdraw from Normandy, the weight of evidence is very much in favour that you do. Because this ties back a little bit as well to what started talking about in the way in which the Allies are adapting to the campaign. And whilst the Germans, you say, were fixed on a particular approach and they keep doing the same kind of thing and the strategy's wrong and the tactics don't really work out too well, the British and the Canadians, and the Americans too, for that matter, are adapting their methods and their doctrines to the situation they find themselves in. And the very weakness of British approach to doctrine, which is make it up as you go along and interpret it fairly loosely, then becomes an advantage because the campaign they're now in doesn't fit with their so well with their starting doctrine, but they're very good at talking amongst themselves, holding informal conferences and formal conferences for that matter. There is a paper trail on this kind of stuff where you can see they start talking to each other and they work out how to adapt and how to, if you like, grow into the campaign. And by August, they've adapted lots of their methods and through late June, July as well. You see this transition. They're starting to be more flexible with their infantry armor formations. They're working more closely together and they're working out the best methods and approaches. So we see with the armored divisions at the start, it's separate for the most part anyway. Within a few weeks, few days actually, of when the Guards Armored arrive, in late June, they're being told this isn't, you can't fight like that, you've got to do it differently. And so later on, within the next few weeks, they start to fight in a much more mixed brigade structure of infantry and armour mixed in balanced forces. So they cooperate and work together. They still got the tactical issues because one of the difficulties of infantry armour cooperation, how do you actually do it at a very low level? How can the infantry talk to the guys inside the tank? There's all this stuff about telephones on the back of the tank. Well, they last about half an hour. If in movement, the things just fall off, get broken. They're using different radio nets. Their communication methods are different. This creates all sorts of difficulties. The armoured commander isn't going to take orders from an infantry commander because infantry don't understand armour and armour don't understand infantry particularly well. So actually how you work that through is really difficult. And that you see these stories of infantry commanders stood on the back of a tank in the open, so exposed quite high up in the air, in the middle of a battle, talking to an armoured commander about how to manoeuvre and how to integrate what their different forces to be effective. One of the things that is quite interesting is at the start of the battle, the idea of infantry riding on the back of tanks was a complete no-no. Health and safety, you can't do it. It's really dangerous. Artillery's flying around all over the place. It breaks all the rules. It's far too dangerous, which in many ways it was. But very quickly, they work out, actually, you've got to. The infantry have got to move with the armour. And until... they used tank rides for a time, and I interviewed a few guys from 11th Armoured, 3rd Royal Tanks, John Langdon and Bill Close and so on, and Robin Lemon, who I did a whole series of interviews with them many years ago. And they talked about how they went through this transition of using different tactics, having the infantry ride with them when they're manoeuvring forward, because they needed the infantry to debus and get straight into action to support the armour, because you can't see anything inside a tank. Visibility is really bad, so you've got to have infantry support in close terrain. Ultimately, the big change, I suppose, is the introduction of kind of pseudo armoured personnel carriers, the Kangaroos, in the beginning of August. I mean, they talked about introducing them for Goodwood, but it was considered too early and not ready and so on. But by Total Eyes, they want to introduce this. So you've got infantry in fully tracked vehicles able to keep up with the tanks with a reasonable degree of protection. So you can actually get them directly into battle, because half tracks aren't so good. They're okay, but fully tracked vehicles really start to solve that problem. And it's the Anglo-Canadian Army that solved that problem first. Tank rides are all very well, but it's quite casualty intensive. Much better to get them in their own armoured personnel type carriers and debus them straight into action. You really start to see that happen by Operation Total Eyes. It doesn't work superbly well throughout, but it works much more effectively than all the previous methods and solves a problem which no other army really has been able to square that particular circle until that time in the war. So you see the...
But I suppose the problem is, of course, is building enough Kangaroos and Rams, isn't it?
Yes, absolutely. And you could argue that why didn't they foresee this before the before it all started? And yes, but again, the British armies and Canadian armies learning experience was in Mediterranean North Africa. So in that environment, that's not so important. That's not such a crucial issue. Right. So you have to work with your experience, and that's where you build your doctrine from. So what's interesting is the fact that the Allies are able to adapt their techniques and their methods during the campaign. They're afforded enough space to do that. So the approach to doctrine would be you wouldn't really want to do doctrine that way, but as it ended up in Normandy and there on in, it actually proved to be a bonus. It got them out of the mess that they'd got themselves into, which is kind of that flexible approach. Whereas you've discussed before about the Germans stick to the automatic counterattack, the doctrine of being aggressive in action. If you lose them, you need to try and get it back. Works most of the time, but if the enemy is firing 7.2-inch rounds at you, en masse, it's probably not a good idea to immediately counterattack. You're going to get minced, and so you should adapt your tactics. And the Germans don't very much. They do change. You know, there is evidence that they do adapt somewhat, but it's not enough. And having a single doctrine works to a degree if it's the right doctrine.
And this process of development and doctrinal growth continues after Normandy, doesn't it? Because suddenly you've got that mobile battle that everyone's been saving up for, haven't you? The rush to Belgium is the most and always is a sort of, you know, is a paragraph at the end of any book about Normandy.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And then they get to Brussels, and it's the most extraordinary phase of the liberation of Europe, and it really you're hard pressed to find much written about it.
Yes, yeah,
in popular history.
Yeah, yeah, no, but I mean, I think we're all guilty of it to a degree. And the book I did on Northwest Europe, that I think about the first three or four chapters are about Normandy and the preparations, one chapter, and then it's Arnhem. You know, well, there's quite a bit going on in between, as you correctly say, and some fantastic stories of Allied troops advancing through the night, driving down roads, and they look over their shoulders and there's a bunch of Germans in a field looking completely bewildered and bemused by the rate of the Allied advance, and it gets scooped up and generals are being caught and everything. So and again, there's a degree of flexibility there, and you know, the Allied armies are often accused of not seizing their moments and their opportunities particularly. Well, this was seized relatively well. And the speed and rate of the advance, and the way in which the engineers and the communications troops managed to keep the forces mobile enough to make the kind of rapid advance and exploit it as much as they could, I mean, it shows a reasonable degree of flexibility and ability to plan as you're going along. I mean, again, you get the carping criticism, which is sometimes, well, they didn't do it well enough. Why didn't they trap the 15th Army? and stop it from getting across and so on? Why did they stop at Antwerp and not go further on in order to block their route out? Well, this is well off the plan by this stage. By that stage of the campaign, they're about eight months ahead of schedule as to where they thought they were going to be by that stage. So they often don't have maps, particularly good maps. They're making it up as they go along. And in those circumstances, that's when some choices can be made which don't quite work out as effectively as perhaps they should. But, I mean, the rate of the advance is just so impressive. And the fact that they're in Brussels, Antwerp and so on, they see those objectives so rapidly by 3rd, 4th September thereabouts, considering where they'd been just a couple of weeks beforehand, just shows the ability of an army such as that. And it's a very mobile army. Yes, they're having to drop units off in order to maximise their fuel and lift capacity. But it's an army that moves really quickly, and it's a mobile army, not necessarily manoeuvre, it's a slightly different thing, but it can move quickly and it's able to seize those opportunities, as indeed the Americans do in the south as well. So it shows what an army with resources and with some degree of flexibility can achieve in an environment like that. They're just pretty effective at it.
Belgium to Antwerp, they're using like road maps, aren't they? They've not got any maps. Yes. They're likely using a traffic map.
And it's kind of the famous old stories of 1940, the Germans stopping at petrol filling stations and pinching the map to find out where the hell they are because they've gone off their own maps. But yeah, the British are having to do that. Comments by Pip Roberts and other leading commanders of 11th Armoured, who's the first into these kind of areas, or one of the first units into these areas, saying exactly that. He says, we were just going hell for leather and trying to capture what we could and travelling through the night when we're not supposed to, and seizing the moment as best they could. And it was kind of more of a strategic choice, I guess, or operational choice, not to advance further out of Antwerp. But you have to look at where they are by that stage. Yes, they could have gone a bit further, but attention was then starting to switch to delivering a knockout blow. Trapping the 15th Army doesn't deliver a knockout blow. It's a good position to take, but it doesn't get you across the Rhine. So you can see why attitudes start to shift and resources start to shift in a different direction by that point, which, of course, is what leads to Market Garden.
Yeah, because, I mean, I often think... And we do talk about Market Garden a lot on this podcast, because it's sort of my entry point to all of this. Is that putting yourself in the position of the people making that decision in early September, or in late August, really? Mm-hmm. Because after all, there's all those other airborne ops being planned, and all with basically the same principal idea that you use it to do another leapfrog. Mm-hmm. That it extends your leapfrog sort of ability. Mm-hmm. If you're not taking that period of the post Normandy battle into account properly, and looking what they're doing, how mobile they can be, if you're not really looking at that as a thing that's happening to them at that very moment, I don't think you can quite understand why they make the decisions they do to go ahead with Market Garden. That what they've achieved is extraordinary. They think, well, we'll squeeze the lemon a bit more and we'll get some more of that out.
Absolutely. And I discussed with a number of times, you know, people look back on it with hindsight and say Market Garden is clearly the wrong choice in September 1944. Well, it's not clearly the wrong choice. Maybe the plan isn't the right plan to go with, but the strategy is sound enough in terms of you want to deliver that knockout blow. You look at your alternatives. The knockout blow is probably trying to get across the Rhine. Maybe Arnhem's not the way to go. And it's really fascinating.
There's the debate about Wesel.
Yes, absolutely. Yeah. And what's fascinating, and I did some stuff on this a few years ago, is about the decision-making process with Monty about why he ends up committing to Market Garden when nearly everybody around him was saying, I think this is a really bad idea. And it's within his 21st Army Group staff, his chief of staff, his chief of plans of operations and so on, and his intelligence chief, were all starting to get cold feet about Market Garden, yet it still goes ahead. And it's kind of an interesting idea about high-level decision makers, you know, they're kind of the great at the top who have to make these big decisions. And there's a point at which their self-worth and self-determination that they're always right starts to run a little bit out of control. Kind of the victory disease idea. Monty's chief logistics officer, Miles Graham, referred to it, Monty's having Baron moments, B-A-R-O-N, Baron moments. He becomes the big leader and you just do what I say. And it runs a little bit out of control by this time. And despite the fact that others are saying this is a bad plan, Monty's big picture view is that we need to get this big knockout punch in order to get across the Rhine. This is the plan I think will work. And so he drives it through against a lot of advice. So it's quite interesting how it runs at that time. You can see why they commit to a big operation. Maybe that's not the one to go with, but you can see why they try and deliver that kind of big knockout blow.
Absolutely. And he's also susceptible to airborne men selling him heroic schemes that will solve all his problems. I mean, in Sicily, after all, you know, Hopkinson, rather than Browning, really, sells him all those glider landings and stuff. Mm. And you know, which causes tension within the airborne world with Chatterton, who's the glider pilot regiment guy, saying to Hopkinson, or at least he says he said to Hopkinson, this isn't going to work. This is completely harebrained. And he's offered the choice of doing it or going home.
Yeah.
And so on. And so it seems, you know, Monty doesn't seem particularly across what can actually be achieved with airborne. And the post-Normandy digestion of airborne, though, actually feeds into the Arnhem plan, which is we'd all like to land in one place together and form up and then fight our battle. Thank you very much.
Historian called Seb Ritchie's done a load of really good work on this, and he looks at the plan for Market Garden and Comet. He's just so critical of the plans and the ideas. And he said, it's as though the previous 2-3 years of airborne ops have been completely forgotten. They don't really apply what they've learned and apply it to this particular operation. He's absolutely right. And it's partly because Monty's not an airborne expert. Why would he necessarily be? It's not his field. So he's reliant on good advice. But Browning partly is to blame for going along with the plan. But Lewis Brereton is as well, because he's the overall Allied Airborne Army commander who gets airbrushed out of this entire thing. Ryan doesn't even interview him when he does A Bridge Too Far. He doesn't appear in the film, yet he's really the person who's he's responsible for carving up the airborne plan and then making Horlicks of it, allegedly. It's understandable why Monty doesn't quite understand how he can use airborne troops, but he should be reliant on advice. Brownie doesn't particularly provide the right kind of, although he has some doubts about Market Garden as well. But you can see how it ends up being enacted. No doubt, really, that looking at the weight of the evidence, that it was a bad plan for that particular moment, far too much of a risk. There were other plans which should have contributed more to possibly getting to the Rhine in September 44. But also, there's the argument maybe the moment has gone. You know, you can only keep advancing so long before you're out of steam. And the British Army has, you know, adapted well to that situation, but it's not really... It's at the end of its tether, if you like, by then. It maybe could have made a few better choices, but you get friction in war. You know, some bad choices will be made in situations like that.
And also, the campaigning season is ending, essentially. I mean, one of the things that does for Arnhem is that the weather's starting to go wrong. And after all, because then you get the sort of, it's not stasis into the winter, and then the building up to breaking into Germany in the spring. By the spring, what's the difference between the Anglo-Canadian armies and Normandy? What's their temperament? What's happening doctrinally? How's it running? Have they shaken out all the sort of gremlins that they were experiencing? That James started off with, you know, where no one is familiar with anyone. They haven't trained together. They don't all speak the same language. Has that all been shaken out by February in preparation for?
I don't think it all has been, but it's a much it's much more coherent force by January, February 1945. And they've got methods and doctrines which they're pretty au fait with now. They know how to make it work. So their methods of infantry armour cooperation have improved. They're still hitting particularly difficulties. They have started to solve problems of, say, German mortars, which has been a real bane of their lives since the early stage of the campaign. They're starting to use better radar techniques to locate where mortars are, and they can counter battery fire them more effectively. That's starting to emerge. The Canadians are ahead of the game on that one. But they still have some issues. One of their biggest problems is how you get infantry to move across open ground behind an artillery barrage. And there are still accounts of junior and middle ranking commanders trying to persuade, cajole their infantry to follow in as much as possible behind an artillery barrage, because that's the best way of getting onto a target before the Germans have had recovery time. But getting infantry to accept that is really difficult. I mean, it's counterintuitive. You don't go near exploding shells, really. But actually, in this instance, you need to be as close to it as possible and hope your artillery is accurate. But I mean, there is the concern. You can see why they might be a bit worried. One Operation Research report indicated that after Varsity, the medical officers and personnel taking shrapnel out of Allied troops discovered about maybe about 20% of it was from their own side. So that's a trifle worrying. I mean, it may be because of the wear and tear on your own artillery, but also there's more artillery being thrown around by you compared to the enemy. But nonetheless, it shows that there is a risk here. But getting your troops to lean into an artillery barrage is really difficult. The other problem they have is, of course, they're running out of junior officers. There's a real crisis and problem by the end of 1944 about convincing anybody to be a junior officer. The worst thing to be in the British Army in this period is a junior officer. The proportional casualty rates are really bad. Generally, the worst thing to be in is in the infantry. The casualty rates are always the highest. But the officer is the person driving you forward, you know, and he has to put himself in the firing line a bit more than most of the others. And senior NCOs are looking at the job in autumn and November, December 1944, and they're being asked, do you want to step up and be an officer? And I said, not really. The pay's not much better. The responsibility is much greater, and my chances of survival diminish rapidly. So getting these guys to do that job is quite difficult. So there is a problem. And infantry casualties and overall casualties spike, obviously, in the during Veritable. The casualties, particularly in the infantry, in January, February 45, really start to go up again.
Yeah, appalling. I mean, I was just back in October, I was at the Reichsfeld and that cemetery there. And it is vast. Mm. I mean, it just goes on forever. I mean, it's like one of the ones in Flanders.
Yes, absolutely. And people forget that. I mean, you were talking earlier about the kind of the gaps in the our understanding or the historiography, what we concentrate on in this campaign, 44-45. And we all get sucked into writing about Normandy. We all quite get sucked into writing about Arnhem. We'll think about Arnhem and Market Garden and so on. And the next thing is they're crossing the Rhine and you're on Lüneburg Heath. Well, there's a huge gap in between. The Reichsfeld battles are really, really casualty intensive. Casualties going through the roof, particularly in the infantry. And part of the problem is, of course, that everything they've learned about how to make these operations work really well, about integrating the kit and the technology and the firepower and the engineering equipment and all that kind of stuff, it all kind of falls away because in the early stages of Veritable, the weather changes completely, all thaws out, it rains like hell, there's mud everywhere, and everything gets stuck. So you're reduced to fighting another infantry battle. Then you call in the heavy artillery, the RAF, yeah. Start bombing towns and things are flattening the places, and it slows things down. And so a number of the difficulties which have been identified come back to plague them a little bit during Veritable. You can't imagine, but you can kind of get an idea of what those soldiers were thinking in February 45, in the middle of all this. They're all being told the war's nearly over. Don't worry, it's time to go home soon and so on. And then they're hit with all of this, and suddenly big casualty rates, the doctrines and techniques which they've refined and honed don't work quite as well as effective as they had been. The Germans are still fighting like hell during this period. If this breaks the German army, this is the final moment where they offer any kind of serious opposition. And after they when they cross the Rhine, the German army effectively starts to melt away, that they've been broken. So that's a really key battle. But you can just imagine that, you know, there's all this talk about, for them, the latest stories about Dresden and the bombing and so on, whether that should have carried on. And if you'd asked the troops in the front line in February 1945, they said, no, bomb, you know, get the war over as quickly as possible. Which doesn't necessarily justify Dresden, I'm not saying that, it may or may not, but in terms of their perspective, this battle, this war is still going on really in a really big way. And I think we sometimes miss that.
And it's taken on the characteristic of the mud and wreckage. They'll all have in their mind that it's a First World War stalemate, mud and blood battle, won't they? Because after all, that's so much of the context for how the Second World War is fought is the First World War. Yeah. The moment things grind to a halt and become an infantry slanging match with giant artillery barrages and all that sort of thing, people's minds are bound to be drawn back to that. And you might think, well, we're stuck. We're not going anywhere now for a very long time.
And that's absolutely the case. The shadow of the Somme, as according to Gary Sheffield once called it, hangs very heavily over World War II battlefields. And, of course, all the soldiers fighting World War II, their fathers and uncles or whatever, had fought in the First World War, and they'd heard all these stories, and they didn't. And I think as well the senior commanders, people like Montgomery, were very conscious of what happened in the First World War and didn't want to repeat it. And that's one of the reasons why he pushes this idea very much of professionalism. We won't expend lives and it's absolutely necessary. And it's not just about military necessity. There is an element of, we can't fight like that again. We don't want to fight like that again. And so we will fight a different kind of war if we can. It's still bad. I mean, the casualty rates in infantry units in Normandy are akin to those of the First World War. It's still very... And the infantry makes up a much smaller proportion of the army in 1944. So the pressures are great. The overall casualties are lower, but that's because they're not in contact for that much time in the Second World War. But the army tries to do what it can to solve the problems of the First World War, and using these kind of techniques and methods and so on, firepower, like logistics, planning, engineering, excellent medical support. If there's an army to get wounded in the Second World War, it's the British Army 1944-45, or the American for that matter. So you certainly don't get wounded in the German Army or suffer from battle exhaustion, because there's no such thing as combat stress in the German Army during the Second World War. You're just faking it. Whereas in the British Army, of course, it's treated with a degree. I wouldn't say necessarily brilliant approach, but it's a degree of understanding.
Well, at least it exists. Yes. I mean,
yes, they recognise it.
They recognise it. They acknowledge they need to do something about it. Gosh, John, this is also, I mean, it.
Because I wanted to ask you all about the American Army and the fact that the remarkable turnaround from, you know, if you think 18 months before D-Day, they're running away at Fondouk, and 18 months further on, they've become this amazingly effective machine, and you can't deny that. And by 1945, by the war's end, they're the kind of, you know, the best army in the world, bar none, aren't they?
Yes,
pretty much.
Absolutely.
And you can't really argue that. But I think maybe we should do that another time.
That's next time.
Yeah,
next time. Come back again, John, if you're happy, because we're being a bit Brit-centric today, and I'm fascinated by that development of the US Army as well. I think it's really, really extraordinary. And the exponential growth, both physically and in terms of their ability and capability, is just astonishing.
Yes.
I think it's often forgotten.
They're from even more of a standing start, aren't they?
Absolutely,
well?
Yeah.
And also didn't fight the Germans in 1940. Mm. So lack both the experience and the sort of hoodoo that the British Army is carrying around with it. Because after all, you know, the British spend a lot of time going, well, you've not fought the Germans, old chap. You don't know what it's like. And what it's like is losing. So,
absolutely. And that's absolutely the case. And the Americans, I mean, there's an idea that Americans come in and don't listen to the British at the start and say, you've just been a bunch of losers since 1940. What have we got to learn from you? And that's only partially true. There's an element of that. But as soon as they start to encounter a few difficulties, they do start listening. I mean, look at the way they adapt their tactical air support methods in North Africa and in the Mediterranean in 43. They start off, this is the plan. This is the doctrine. We've got a field manual which tells us exactly how to do this. And within a few months, that actually it doesn't work, this does it? And Tedder and Conyngham and so on in the Mediterranean say, no, well, we told you so. Now let's have a chat about how we do it better. Learn from us. And they did to a degree, but they then took it further because they had the greater resources and capacity. And they weren't worried about what had happened for the previous 2 years in the war. They hadn't had that experience. Whereas, you rightly say, the British were always, well, remember what happened in 1940? It can all go badly wrong. And that does affect it is going to affect your mentality, certainly.
Yeah. Well, we'll talk about more of that next time. Yeah. John, it's been such a pleasure to talk to you, and we'll have you.
I've got pages of notes now.
Oh dear!
I'm like one of your students now. But yeah, thank you. That was just utterly fascinating. So thank you.
Great stuff. Thanks very much.
Thanks everyone for listening. See you soon. Cheerio.
Bye. Cheerio.